What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hey, what is going on, everybody? And welcome to Listen, Money Matters. Money is not the most important thing in the world. Love is. Fortunately, I love money. My name is Thomas, and I'm here, as always, with my good friend Andrew. Andrew, is that a quote from a movie or something? I feel like I've heard that before.
I think so. In true asshole form, didn't even say who it was from. I just grabbed the quote, and I was like, perfect.
You were the worst kind of media person.
Yeah.
Didn't your English teacher in fourth grade ever tell you to cite your sources? Where's your bibliography?
I'll tell you what. to be fair, I will guarantee that I will not cite it in the show notes.
Oh, okay. That seems fair, I guess, in like a making it worse kind of way. Anyway, what are you drinking today, man?
Today, I'm just drinking a board meeting. I figured it was fitting, and it's like a coffee beer, so it's good.
It's an excellent name for a beer,
right?
For a podcast that has multiple people on it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just drinking my caffeine-free tea, which is not actually tea, but they love to call it tea.
What is it?
So it's pretty good. It's Fireside Vanilla Spice from Celestial Seasonings. And I learned recently that the factory is actually in Boulder, Colorado.
Oh,
so
shit.
So you can go to it and tour it and kind of like do whatever you want there.
Tea things.
Buy tons of tea. All sorts of stuff like that. So Anna brought a bunch back, and I've just been drinking it all the time. It's really good. It's bagged, but it's really good. So, guys, today I think this is our first guest interview in quite a while.
Yeah.
Possibly of the year,
I think, if I'm
not mistaken.
Yeah.
But today, guys, so we're going to talk about a topic that I don't think we've really dug into that much on this show, which is the idea of diversifying your portfolio.
We give it a lot of lip service. But I don't think we really...
We give it a lot of lip service, and I think usually when we mention it in the context of buying mutual funds or buying an array of funds that diversify as compared to owning a single stock.
Right.
But there's a lot more to diversification, and there's a lot more that we don't know. So today we have a guest on the show. His name is Adam Graylist. Hopefully I pronounced that right. And he is a senior researcher at Betterment, which is one of our favorite companies. So, Adam, how's it going?
Great. Thanks for having me on. Excited to chat a little bit about this topic that's near and dear to my heart and certainly many of the other people here at Betterment.
Absolutely. So are you at Betterment's offices right now?
Yeah. Yeah. I'm in one of the smaller conference rooms. So hopefully it will provide some good acoustics.
Gotcha. I was wondering if we would see you in the board game room.
I'm on a different floor. It's much more boring here. All the conference rooms in this floor are named after authors, and I'm in a conference room named Darwin.
The Darwin conference. Well, they should put a bunch of taxidermied animals on the wall then.
I'm looking over to the corner, and there is an Origin of Species book in the corner, and a skeleton of an ape. And a human, so a little bit on theme here.
That's pretty good. All you're showing us is a bunch of painted wood.
Yeah.
You didn't want to have the skeleton in the background?
Yeah, in the corner.
So, Adam, tell us a little bit about like how you got involved with Betterment and what got you interested in diversification.
Sure, of course. So, looking at and ultimately joining Betterment was I was looking for a company where I deeply aligned with the mission. And to me, the mission of Betterment is to use technology to offer the best possible wealth management, the kind that was previously only available to institutions or super high net worth individuals, and take technology to make it accessible to everyone at a low cost. So that was a mission that I felt really aligned with. And my previous 10 years of experience of particularly thinking about problems from a systematic and technological point of view fit really well.
Gotcha. So let's use Betterment actually as a jumping off point to talk about diversification. because as anybody who has an account knows, or as anybody who's listened to this show for any amount of time knows, basically the way Betterment works is you set a risk tolerance slider, or I suppose a slider that defines what your priorities are, either growth or maybe a little bit more conservative approach, and that's going to balance all of the funds you have available across different asset classes, across different funds, all that kind of thing.
Yep.
So I suppose like that is a good example of diversification. We're not just pouring everybody's money into Tesla or into Apple. It's not only put into one fund, which has many, you know, hundreds or thousands of individual stocks or bonds within it, but across many different funds.
Yeah. Yeah. I think there's a good way that I think about it is sort of a hierarchy, where the most risky thing you can do is buy one individual stock, because hey, listen, yeah, it might go up, but you're subjected to as much risk as possible. So not only what's broadly going on with the market, which might buffet the stock up and down, but also anything particular to that sector and also that individual company. So even if the market is going well and that rising tide raises all boats, and even if say the sector is going really well, but there's some sort of scandal that befalls the individual company, there's just so many layers of risk that you end up taking on. So you can improve on that by owning a couple of stocks. What does a couple of stocks do? Well, it doesn't protect me from necessarily sector risk or overall market risk, but it does protect me from if one company, you know, the CEO turns out to be a crook, that's not really going to affect the other company in my portfolio at that point. So you're starting to see like the beginning of diversification at that point.
Yeah. This is like mercantile era style diversification, where investors in England would, you know, put 10% of their gold on, you know, one of 10 ships. So that way, if one sinks, they only lose 10% of the gold. So yeah, it's like individual ship level diversification.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Moving further along is instead of owning a few and maybe they're all in the same sector, you can own across multiple sectors. And at this point, you're getting closer to owning a broader swath of the economy. So to go back to the ship analogy, this would be, don't just send it by ship, but also send it by plane, also send it by submarine, also send it by ground to the extent possible. So
now when you say sector, can you give me a couple of examples of sectors just to kind of solidify the picture?
Sure, of course. So sectors are basically broad industries of the economy. So you can think about technology, healthcare, financial companies, so kind of these very broad, very, very broad industries within any economy.
Okay, so if we have, maybe this isn't a great example because I feel like an agricultural bad year would affect many different market sectors, but just for the sake of example, if you were invested in, Deloitte and Monsanto and stuff like that, and we had a really bad year agriculturally, having money also in the technology sector with Apple and Tesla and things like that, and having money in healthcare, that's going to shield your portfolio somewhat from the losses in that one sector.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a great example. I mean, what crop yields are this year is probably not going to affect demand for semiconductors in any material way.
But I feel like it might, though. So I guess this is something I was worried about is, it's something that's so fundamental to human life, like crop yields, especially with technology becoming more and more demanded in developing countries. I feel like a crop yield fluctuation could actually affect demand for many different things, especially in countries where crop yields are, a swing would be felt much more intensely.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Honestly, I haven't looked at the data to understand exactly how something like crop yields might affect other sectors, even seemingly unrelated ones. I would certainly agree economies that particularly emerging market economies where where commodities and agriculture are a bigger part of the economy, mm-hmm. That's going to have a much more systemic effect on overall wealth levels in that country. So if a country, you know, to use perhaps an exaggerated example, 50% of wealth is generated through agriculture, well, you know, that's going to have a knock-on effect for retail business, for example, or you know, buying iPhones. So
I was going to say, maybe to seize on that example a little bit, I think like right now, 50% of like the money made isn't in agriculture, but a lot of people might feel that like tech or like the FANG stocks, like those are the ones that are making money.
What's FANG?
Facebook, Apple, Google.
That's right.
Amazon. Netflix. Something. What do you say?
Netflix.
Yes. Netflix. So you might think, well, I could definitely be invested in healthcare, you know, and maybe in utilities, but shouldn't I be overweighted in technology? Because it'd be stupid to miss all that upside.
Yeah. Well, one, as so if you're investing passively in the entire U.S. economy, as these sectors are growing, you end up, it becomes a larger percent of your portfolio and you do end up participating. Certainly not the same as if you have an overweight to, you know, five or six particularly well-known companies. I guess the one thing to say about that is it's particularly hard to forecast what the future growth and future performance of these companies is going to be. And certainly just because they have done well in the past is not particularly instructive on what they might do in the future. Pulling up one example, you know, we might think about BlackBerry back in the day. That was certainly had an atmospheric rise or meteoric rise and looked like it was an unstoppable force for communication, particularly in the business world. And, you know, things changed quite a bit, particularly with the introduction of the iPhone. So, it's difficult to predict, and looking back on what previously happened is usually not the most instructive thing to be looking at.
So we talked about, I guess, the first two levels of diversification.
Yeah.
And I think these are the easiest ones for people to take action on. We have company level diversification and sector level diversification. So if you think about it from a stock perspective, it's very easy to buy stocks for multiple companies to cover your bases on the first level, and then to buy stocks across multiple different sectors, or to get invested in a fund that does invest itself across multiple sectors, like the Vanguard Total Stock Index that we talk about so much in this podcast. But something that I didn't think about very often until very recently was the idea that the overall performance of the economy is something where you can be, where you can have a lack of diversification. And this kind of blew my mind. I was listening to J. David Stein's podcast, Money for the Rest of Us, and he mentioned that even a portfolio that is 40% bonds, so 60% stock, 40% bonds, because of the volatility of stocks, 99% of your returns are going to be driven by the stock portion of that portfolio. Mm-hmm. So if you have a period of overall economic downturn, then the bonds in that portfolio are not really going to save it, because of the volatility of the stocks. So I guess, how do you go about constructing a portfolio that that can weather a period of economic downturn, or that maybe could even take advantage of a period of economic downturn? I would imagine there are industries out there that do tend to surge when inflation rises or when people are fearful, things like that.
Yep. Yeah. I mean, this is a challenging problem. So first, definitely, stocks are more volatile than bonds. So that's why that statement is true, that, you know, even if you have 50% stock and 50% bonds, if stocks are three times more volatile, the overall volatility of your portfolio is going to be, most of the contribution is going to come from stocks over bonds. So, you know, how do you kind of deal with this fact? You know, I would say there's a couple of things. Like, one, we've talked about diversification kind of going up to the individual country economy level. There is one more level of diversification that you can eke out, which is going outside of the U.S. and investing not only in the U.S., broad U.S. economy, but also international developed and emerging market economies. They tend to move together to a certain extent, but certainly not in lockstep. And anytime you get funds or assets that are moving out of sync with one another, you'll end up benefiting from some diversification benefit there. Mm-hmm. So that's certainly one piece of it. The other piece is kind of what do you do through time as markets are evolving? And probably one of the best things to do is to periodically rebalance your portfolio. So as imagine there's a period of particular market turbulence and stocks have gone down. If you look at your overall portfolio and say you're trying to maintain this 60% stock, 40% bond ratio, stocks have gone down by a lot. Now they're say 55% of your portfolio and bonds are 45. So to maintain that ratio, you end up buying more stocks. And if you think about how that interaction works, as stocks are falling in value, they become a smaller part of your portfolio. This is when you're buying them. Conversely, as the stock market does particularly well, they become overweight in your portfolio and you're selling them after they've gone up. So, I like to think that the primary reason for rebalancing is to control your risk, that you've identified that 60-40 is the right risk for what you're trying to achieve, but it also has this knock-on beneficial effect of buying when a certain asset class has gone down and selling after it's increased.
So buy low, sell high.
Yeah, exactly. It has that nice property to it. It's a very nice property of rebalancing beyond just the simple risk control piece.
Okay. So 60-40, I mean, that's just an example that I heard on a podcast. Yeah. Given your financial goals, I mean, everyone listening to this podcast is going to have a different set of goals given their age, given what they want to do in life. How do you determine both what should be in your portfolio and what the different allocation percentages should be?
Yeah. Yeah, great question. It's something we spend a lot of time thinking about. And one of the most straightforward ways to think about kind of sizing the amount of risk you should be taking is along two dimensions. One, investment term, when will I need this money? And then what will it be used for? Particularly, what will my liquidation look like? So for example, if this is for a major purchase, like a house or a car or a boat, I'm going to need this in 5 years. And at the end, I'm going to use all that money all at once. Versus, say, a retirement goal where I may need this money starting in 20 years, but then I'll be spending down this money not in one shot, but over the subsequent 30 years. So both these pieces of the equation play into how much risk you should be taking. We've built models to kind of put you where you need to be on the risk spectrum, given those two dimensions. And it works intuitively, as you might expect. As your goal gets shorter, you want more certainty around your risk. If you're going to be spending all your money at one time, like a major purchase goal, it's also going to skew you towards less risk.
Right. So I guess this is something that we should state again, because I think it's very important. A lot of people who are around my age, early 20s, maybe even early 30s, you know, they're always thinking, I have all of these years until retirement, so it makes sense to take the risk now. And in many cases, that is true, but it is for that retirement goal. And like you say, if you've got a short-term purchase coming up, like a house or something like that, then you need to almost treat that money like a 55-year-old person would treat their retirement savings. Though it is actually a little different because you're planning on spending it all at once rather than dripping it out over 20 or 30 extra years.
Yeah.
So you want to hedge yourself against a potential economic downturn that is unfortunately timed with when you want to buy that house.
That's exactly right. And that's why we're a huge proponent of what you just described, we call goal-based investing. So you, in the process of planning how you envision your future to look, does it involve a new car, a new house? Does it involve kids? Do you want to send those kids to college and obviously retirement? As these goals sort of materialize in your life, each one necessitates a slightly different treatment for a slightly different target amount of money. And treating each one of these goals somewhat individually helps you to, as you had mentioned, ensure that you have the money you need at the time that you need it.
Yeah. So that, and I guess one point to add to this is, you know, if you do want your money to grow and you are young, then one thing that you have working in your favor is that you don't realize losses until you sell. So if we do have a situation like 2008, 2009 happen again, and you can't afford to keep your money in the market for the next 20 years, assuming that things happen as they have happened for the last 90 years or so, instead of it being like an Armageddon scenario, you're probably going to realize all those losses again. Or not realize, you're probably going to make up for all those losses.
Yeah. Yeah.
As long as you can leave the money in the market.
And think, taking it one step further, if you're practicing rebalancing along the way, you also were able to move some of your bond holdings into stocks as stocks were at rock bottom levels, should have helped.
Yeah, that's right. So what were you going to say, Andrew?
I was just going to comment on the goal-based piece. So I haven't been able to have a Betterment account for a while. And maybe you can like affirm or I don't know. But it is essentially what you're saying is it's not enough to create a Betterment account and perhaps just say money for later and put it all in, but essentially create sub-buckets within your Betterment account that you guys have built an easy way to do, based on a goal. And then I guess my question to you is like, so say I have the retirement goal and I have my saving for a home goal. Do I need to keep in my mind what the risk sliders are and the breakdown? Or can I just say, hey, Betterment, I need this money in 5 years and you'll recommend / automatically slide my money accordingly?
Yes. The short answer to that is yes to all of that.
Sweet.
yeah, so you can create multiple goals. We recommend, based off of what you tell us about each one of those goals, what risks you should have. And then you can turn it on autopilot and we will adjust your risk from where it should be at the start. And as time goes by, decrease risk as you get closer to the end of your investing term. So you can, you know, really put it on autopilot in a number of ways. One, on your overall risk for each goal and how that evolves through time, de-risking as you get closer to your goal. Also in terms of rebalancing, making sure that as the market is fluctuating, that we're keeping your portfolio risk in line with where it should be at that point in time. And if it's in a taxable account, doing it in a way that is tax aware. So not realizing short-term gains, doing some other tax strategies where it makes sense for individual customer situations, like, for example, tax loss harvesting.
So before you came on, you had had sent over an article that you had written that I found fascinating, particularly because of this one concept you discussed called the efficient frontier. And when I thought of diversification, my layman thoughts were like, well, I'll have some real estate, I'll have some stocks, I'll have some bonds, you know, maybe VTI, the Betterment, or the Vanguard fund that is, you know, the stock market is a great pick. But how do you really decide what is the best diversification? I think this concept defines that. Could you explain what the efficient frontier is?
Sure. Yeah. You know, to some people, this might be a totally new set of words and new concepts. So, you know, do my best to kind of shed some light on it. And it starts with one pretty simple concept, and that's that risk and return are related to one another, and that risk is bad and returns are good. So there's a secondary concept in that as we mix assets together that do not move entirely in lockstep, we're able to reduce risk without necessarily adversely impacting return. So that set of facts allows us to create mix assets together, mix assets together in a way that keeps perhaps the return equal, but reduces the risk. So you can imagine a simple example where you have U.S. stocks and U.S. bonds. If you start mixing those two together, they actually have less overall risk on that portfolio level than the simple average of the two things together. And this is because when stocks go up, bonds might go down. So the overall portfolio ends up being less risky. And what the efficient frontier is it's the outer boundary of how much return you can get for any level of risk. So you can imagine a moderately risky portfolio. You could construct a couple of different ones. One, for example, again, going back to our idea of individual stocks, you could have something that displays moderate risk with one individual stock. If you start adding in more securities into it that don't move together, you end up decreasing the risk while not necessarily adversely impacting return. And the efficient frontier is the boundary of how much extra stuff you can add before you've kind of reached your limit. So it's the outer boundary of most return you can get for any given level of risk.
So one thing that I think is incredibly instructive that is unfortunately unable to be conveyed on the podcast is this image that you included. And so it has essentially a line, and it's like not like a one, like a X equals one, like a whatever, but it's a straight line of the maximum amount of return you can get for the risk. And then there's a bunch of like gray dots in there of all of the possible portfolios. And so this is like me imagining, and perhaps you can correct me if I'm wrong, but you essentially take all of the potential components that could be in a portfolio and just run enormous back tests to determine like which ones you would add in at, I don't know, 60% stock, 40% bond to get the highest return at the lowest risk.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So, unfortunately this image is very helpful for explaining this concept that's a little bit more difficult to do in words. The amount of times I end up drawing this simple efficient frontier chart in my work life, you know, it seems like at least once a week, thinking about perhaps getting it tattooed onto part of my body, it would take everybody some time.
Understand diversification. Take a look at my chest.
Yeah. So, but yeah, that's exactly right. Is you can imagine taking you know all of the stocks in the U.S. and mixing them together every which way possible, and for each portfolio that you end up creating, understanding how much return it had and how risky that portfolio was, and just plotting all those points. And what ends up happening is you find at a certain point that for any given level of risk, there are no points higher up. There's no higher return that you can achieve. And if you move across risk levels, you end up seeing Like it has this kind of curving shape to it where as you go into higher levels of risk, you get more return, but at a decreasing rate. So that's kind of what that chart looks like.
So it's law of diminishing returns based on the risk level rising.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And there's some kind of interesting thought as to why that is that I'm happy to go into as well.
Please.
The biggest thing to think about, if you can imagine all these possible portfolios, that eventually there's just some line that they can't cross. You just can't create a portfolio that is any better than this one created at each level of risk. And that outer boundary is called the efficient frontier. So you generally want your portfolio that you're invested in to be on or very close to that efficient frontier. Because what it means is that you're getting the most amount of return for the level of risk that you're taking.
Right.
So you have all this past data for all of these funds, stocks, et cetera, and you determine the betterment portfolios as per whatever the allocation, 60-40 stock based on this. And I guess my first thought is you run this test and these are the results, but in 3 months, 6 months from now, it's probably going to be different just because things are weird and whatever. So how do I imagine the betterment portfolios change as a result of that? And then I guess, how do you do that? How often does that happen? Is there a cost because you're obviously selling some of the things in my portfolio and buying other ones?
Yeah, this is a great question. I'm glad that you brought it up because the way that we were just explaining efficient frontiers.
It's like yesterday's efficient frontier.
Yeah, exactly. So so what we do at Betterment I guess the one thing, taking one step back, is on the efficient frontier, the thing that we really, so we have risk on one hand and returns on the other. The thing that we really care about our portfolio is the future risk of the portfolio and the future returns. Mm. So you can certainly plot what happened in the past, but what you really care about is what we expect the future returns of each of these assets and each of these portfolios to be, and the future risk of these portfolios. So to do that, we have a separate process that is actually coming up with our expectation of what we think each asset class's future return will be, and what we expect its future risk to be. And then combining those together into portfolios and seeing what those look like. So it's not based entirely on backwards looking data, which means that if something changes over the course of a month or two, our entire efficient frontier doesn't shift around. And the way we go about, so the main point that's important to think about is the efficient frontier cares about future returns and future risk. And so we're doing our best to plot where we think portfolios will be on these two dimensions. The way that we go about thinking about future risk is pretty interesting. We use a process called Black Litterman, which is a couple of fancy words, but basically what it means is we take the global allocation of stock and bonds, so the global market cap of stock and bonds. So we understand how every investor in the world has kind of where they've put their chips, right? You know, each investor is trying to be smart and getting information, coming up with their own understanding of what might be a valuable investment, and you know, putting their chips where they may be around the world of global investments. So seeing that, we now know the weights to the global market cap portfolio. We know that About 60% of all assets are in bonds, and around 40% are in stocks. And we know that around 40-odd% of stock assets are in the U.S. and 60% outside the U.S. So once we know these weights, and we can also measure the risk to all these asset classes, risk tends to be a bit more stable, and you can look at how risky it was historically, and it tends to be a fairly good predictor of what risk will be in the future. Once we know the weights of this global portfolio and the risk associated with each of those assets, we can then back out what the implied expected return is for each one of these asset classes. Mm. If you think about a traditional portfolio, you have an idea of how risky it is, and you have an idea of what the returns are. And from those two things, you can come up with some weights of how much you think you should have of each one of these things. Well, if we have weights and risk, we can just reverse the process, and we can actually back out the global implied expected return for each asset class. So it's basically telling us what the sum of all the investors who are putting money to work, what they think the implied future return of this asset class is. So that's what roots our efficient frontier, which tends to be quite a bit more stable because it's rooted in global market caps, which just don't move around the same amount.
So you can use the allocations of all investors to extrapolate what they expect to happen on a global aggregate scale.
Yeah, exactly.
Which, and I mean, as we know, markets fluctuate based on expectations and perceptions just as much as they do on, you know, actual things happening in reality. So that makes sense. Did you say that 40% of all stocks, all stock investing is in the U.S. globally?
Yeah, you know, I have to double check on the exact number, but it's around that.
So almost half of the world's dollars invested in stocks are invested in U.S. companies.
Yeah.
That is higher than I would have expected. I mean, I know the U.S. economy is gigantic, but I would not have expected that 40% of all stocks were, or I guess all stock dollars were invested in U.S. companies. So I guess to bring things down to maybe a little bit more actionable level, something that the average person could maybe grab onto a little better. I read about something called the all-weather portfolio.
Yep.
You heard about that?
Yep.
So I guess, number one, can you explain what the all-weather portfolio is? Because I think that's something that would be feasible to construct for the average person if they wanted to. And then I guess the second question in my head, which kind of piggybacks off of that, is what is the benefit, if any, to constructing an all-weather portfolio versus constructing a very conservative portfolio that's just less volatile on the whole?
Right. So when you say all weather, I take it you mean in reference to Bridgewater's all weather portfolio, which is a risk parity portfolio.
Yeah.
So broadly, the all weather fund is an implementation of a strategy called risk parity. And risk parity seeks to balance the risk contribution from each asset in the portfolio. So we had talked about a little bit earlier that even if you have a 50% stock, 50% bond portfolio, because stocks are, say, three times more volatile, if you look at the volatility contribution of stocks versus bonds, it's going to be overwhelmed by the stock piece versus bonds. So that's the underlying idea behind a risk parity portfolio, is that each individual asset class contributes an equal amount in risk terms, not in dollar terms. Functionally, what this means is you have portfolios with a lot of bonds in them relative to the amount of stock that's in them.
Okay.
So, using our 3-to-1 example, if we wanted to have equal contribution from both, we're going to have three times more bonds than we do stocks. So it's going to be a very low allocation of stocks, very high allocation to bonds. Mm-hmm. So this ends up being a pretty efficient portfolio, high Sharpe ratio. So by efficient, I mean how much return do you expect to get for each additional amount of risk that you're taking. Going back to this idea of the efficient frontier that we had traced out in our minds, and we know that this thing is not going up at a 45 degree angle. It's kind of going up at a decreasing rate. If we're down in the lower end of risk, we're getting a lot more return per unit of risk. So these tend to be pretty efficient portfolios. The problem, and I'm not sure who to attribute this quote to, but there's a famous quote that's, you can't eat risk-adjusted return, which is to say, sure, great, my portfolio is returning 2% off of very little risk. That's great, but 2% return is still 2% return. So even though it's achieving this efficiently, it is not hitting, it's not growing my money enough for me to reach my retirement goals, say. So
yeah, and that's what I was wondering about, because I feel like I could just put all my money in treasury bonds and make 2% without having to worry about, you know, gold allocation versus treasuries versus stocks and all that kind of stuff. Is the result going to be the same?
It's going to be different. The idea is that this is a portfolio of already risky assets. So this is going outside of treasuries and into assets that are riskier and then trying to balance those risks. Because you could invest in something. Treasuries are generally considered risk-free as long as you're holding them to term. So this is kind of a framework we're thinking about once we're taking a step off the ledge into risky assets in the hopes of getting more return. So we're thinking about corporate bonds and perhaps real estate, perhaps commodities, stocks, maybe longer duration treasuries as well, these types of assets. So, but the risk parity portfolios tend to be very, very efficient, good risk adjusted return, but the return itself is small. So the solution to this problem, again, so this is small. The problem being the return is not high enough for me to reach any of my financial goals. So the solution for risk parity products is they have to introduce leverage at this point. So they take this very efficient portfolio that's yielding, let's say, 3%, 3.5%, and they lever it two times. So now they're getting 6% or 7%, and now we're in the ballpark of a portfolio that's returning something that's a healthy return that can actually be meaningful.
Can you just briefly explain exactly how that leverage works? We've done an entire episode on leverage, and I still sometimes don't exactly know what leverage means.
Yeah, it's probably perhaps. Becomes increasingly confusing when there's a number of different ways to get leverage. So start with perhaps the simplest to understand, which is margin, which is simply borrowing money to buy something else. So this is literally borrowing money from a brokerage at some interest rate, say 1.5% or 2%. And they've literally extended you a loan. So I had $100 with my brokerage, and then I've also asked them for an additional $100, and they say, fine, here's $100, and you're going to owe us 2% a year, or $2 a year on that $100. Go forth and do what you want with it. So now my purchasing power has doubled, and now I have $200 to deploy into the market, in the hopes, obviously, that the things that I buy go up in value. Particularly lucky, and my investment goes up by 50%. I've invested $200. I now have $300. I sell it. I return my $100, $102 back to the brokerage, and now I'm left with $200 off my original $100 investment. So I have 100% return on my on on my own capital, my $100 investment, because
you put $100 in to begin with,
yep,
and then you borrowed another $100.
Yep.
Okay. So basically it's money that you don't own that's been sort of extended to you at a rate of interest that you're using to get more bang for your buck than you could with your own assets.
Yep. Yeah, that's exactly right. And of course the risk here is instead of portfolio that I've purchased going up by 50%, what happens if it goes down by 50%?
You're eating into your original principal to pay back the loan.
Exactly. So this is the risk to it. In fact, you could end up losing more money than you actually have, right? The portfolio could go from $200 in value to $50 in value, in which case you're in a whole heap of trouble because you can't.
So if you leverage over 100%, now like you're inviting the possibility that you could have losses that you couldn't pay back.
Exactly. And okay. Yeah, so that's a risk. It's one that is very stringently controlled by the lender of the money, mm-hmm, because the price of your portfolio is evolving through time and is unlikely to go from $200 to $50 instantaneously.
Right.
They are going to monitor the value of your portfolio. And as that gets below a certain level, they're going to say, hey, we're not feeling comfortable about this. We're worried you're going to be able to pay us back. So you either need to give us more money as kind of collateral, mm-hmm, or we're going to start selling these securities to get back. Because we want...
So they have the right to sell your securities,
yeah,
with their leveraged money.
Exactly. So they're going to make sure that they get their $100 back. So they're, yeah, keeping an eye on the portfolio value. So yeah, broadly you can think of leverage as borrowing money to increase your spending power.
Gotcha. Okay.
And if your investment goes up, this is great. You've just increased your return by more than you could have with your with the actual money that you had. And then there's the risk that you could lose quite a bit more. So broadly, that's the way to think about leverage. Margin is one way to get it. Functionally, in a lot of these risk parity funds, they tend to use different ways to get leverage, either by using futures contracts or by using other derivatives, which essentially has a similar underlying economics, but the money is not mechanically changing hands in the exact same way. It has, yeah, more the underlying nature of these contracts. But fundamentally, like in thinking about it in your head, you can think about it in a fairly similar way.
Okay. And maybe someday we could do a whole deep dive episode on these parity funds. But I was just curious on, you know, what's the difference fundamentally between them and just a very conservative fund. So I guess to really simplify it, correct me if I'm wrong here, a fund like the All Weather portfolio, during good times, you've got all these different asset classes that don't really move in lockstep. But if it was good times, then they're going to return better than a really conservative portfolio would. Correct? Is that kind of the idea here?
I don't know if that's exactly true. Because like generally when we think good times, we think stocks going up.
Mm, and right.
In general, a risk parity portfolio might have, you know, 20% of its risk allocated towards stocks and 25% towards commodities and 25% towards bonds and 25% towards other things. So the idea is for it to kind of in a good market to not outperform and in a bad market to not underperform, for it to trudge ahead.
Yeah.
So to speak. So how it would compare to a conservative traditional portfolio, I guess I would say it depends on how much stock was in your traditional portfolio. If you called a traditional portfolio a 60-40 stock bond mix, that in a quote unquote good market, one where equities are doing well, a priori, I would expect that portfolio to do better than a risk parity fund. I would expect the risk parity fund, again, like this is just kind of thinking very broadly, to perform better than the 60/40 portfolio in a bad market, just simply because it's holding less equity risk. You know, perform doesn't let, you know, lower highs, lower, higher lows, I guess would be one way to think about it.
Okay. Maybe we should just get Ray Dalio on the podcast to explain it. Definitely.
If you could pull that one off.
Yeah, that would be pretty incredible. But Adam, thank you so much for coming on the show. I think that I at least have a much better understanding of diversification. And even if people don't get super into all the stuff about Efficient Frontier, I think you providing that illustration of the different levels of diversification across companies, sectors, economies, and then countries is very useful when thinking about constructing a portfolio. And obviously people can, you know, dial it automatically and not think about it if they are using Betterment. But if they are using a more DIY approach, I think this is going to be very helpful, especially as they start thinking about shorter term goals in the future.
Yeah.
Or getting older.
And we'll include a link to this amazing article that Adam put together, and perhaps some few tangential stuff on the site. Like I remember Dan created this awesome interactive graph between international allocations and US only. It's kind of like a visualization of the Betterment stock slider or allocation slider. All the good stuff if you just like slider faces. One direction.
Yeah.
Left, right, up. I don't know.
However you bring show notes up on your app.
Yeah.
So Adam, thanks again for coming on the show, man. And if you have anything else, parting thoughts, go ahead.
Yeah. So one other topic that kind of really quickly that is related to risk parity and leverage and the efficient frontier. So I kind of mentioned before that as you go up in the risk level, the efficient frontier kind of starts to bend, still going up, but it kind of flattens out. What's the reason for that? And the reason for that is similar to what's going on with risk parity. And it basically comes down to leverage aversion. So ideally, if I don't care about taking leverage risk, which means I could like lose everything, right? That's the risk of leverage. I borrow $100 and my portfolio now worth $200 goes down by 50%. I lose everything. If you don't want to take leverage, either because you are worried about that or you just have some structural mandate that says that you can't, say you're a nonprofit company and that's part of your investment policy is that you can't take leverage. All of these things mean the only way for you to get return is by moving into riskier assets. Right. And because there's a lot of demand for just absolute return, just your actual level of return, that means there's more people buying these assets than they would be buying the more risk efficient assets that are lower in risk. And because more people are buying them, the price goes up, which means the return is lower.
The return goes down. Okay.
So the return goes down. So this means that if I want to get 20% risk, I have to take, if I want to get 20% return, and I don't want to use leverage, I have to take a lot more risk than finding a 10% return portfolio and leveraging it up. So this is the reason why the efficient frontier flattens out as you get into higher levels of risk. It's also the reason why the risk parity portfolio, you need to use leverage. It's a very risk efficient portfolio, but you have such a small amount of returns that you have to use leverage to get to anywhere where you might care about the level of return. So this is one difference between risk parity and a non-risk parity portfolio. Like if you do not want to use leverage, you have no choice but to be on the efficient frontier and taking a bit more risk to get that same level of return. So
that makes sense.
So because there's an overall aversion to leverage, one because of the risk associated with it, and two because of any structural constraints that might exist in how you're even allowed to invest. You end up seeing more people buying higher risk stuff, pushes up the price and decreases future return.
Supply and demand curves. And we are back to economics 101 freshman year of college. But yeah, that makes sense. Again, Adam, thank you for explaining that. I'm sure there are extra things we could go into in a future episode. So for anybody listening to this, our email address, as always, is listenmoneymatters@gmail.com. Send us your questions. If you have extra details you'd like to learn about diversification or these risk parity portfolios or anything like that, let us know. Your questions inform future episodes, and they're very helpful to us. So thank you for that. Adam, where should people go if they want to connect with you or read more of your work?
Yeah, they can check me out at betterment.com. If they go to the Resource Center, they can see articles that I've written, articles that my very talented colleagues have written, and learn a lot more about how we think about investing. There's contact info there as well to get in a hold of myself or anyone else.
Cool. All righty. Well, we'll have links to those articles in the show notes, along with lots of extra details, possibly some of those graphs we talked about. If not, we'll have links to them over on Betterment's website. So check out the show notes if you want to get more details about this topic. listenmoneymatters.com/show. And that's where you can find all the show notes for all of our past episodes. As always, you can look in your podcast app as well, but the website's a great resource to look at. It has lots of other articles on it as well. So thanks for listening. Last but not least, you can always, as always, check out our toolbox of resources for budgeting your money and investing more effectively over at listenmoneymatters.com/toolbox. And we will see you in next week's episode. Later, guys.
Later, man.
Please tell your friends about this show.